Hey there, I'm your host, Paul. A few points of context ahead of today's show. First, thank you for listening. I realize there's a lot of material out there, and I'm grateful that you'd spend your time with us. Second, if you want to get a sense of my background and the team that makes this happen, go to paulpodolsky.com. And lastly, if you like the material, please submit a review on Apple Podcasts. Those reviews are the currency of the modern creator economy. This show's been downloaded tens of thousands of times, yet less than 1% of listeners leave a review. And the same, by the way, goes for the essays about politics and money on Substack, and also the books, Master Minion and Raising a Thief, and the book that's going to be out next year, Uncomfortable Truths About Money. And with that, let's jump in. My guest today is Barton Hooper, who is an equity expert, and welcome to Things I Didn't Learn in School.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Some people will probably know you, but many people won't. So just give a few minutes about your background, who you are, and how you came to this expertise.
I'm not sure expert is the right term, but I have been around for a while now in equities and on the buy side. But I started my career years ago as an accountant at Deloitte & Touche on the auditing side. I think they now just refer to themselves as Deloitte. And after about 3 years of that, decided that I didn't want to stare at payables invoices any longer. And so went to business school, went into small market M&A firm in Kansas City, Missouri, and then eventually decided after working for a while there, and I thoroughly enjoyed doing transactions, but after a while they make you a salesperson, and I'm terrible at sales, I'll admit it. Or at least I was when I was 30 years old. So I just look for ways to apply the skill that I had learned as an accountant and in banking. And I always enjoyed the valuation part of business. So I ended up on the buy side. And through a winding road, I ended up here in Omaha, Nebraska, working for a company called White's Investments. And I've been here since 2008.
So this is our first time speaking, but I was reaching out sort of in my network, and the topic I wanted your help and insight on, I think people would really be interested in, is how you think about the valuation, particularly of U.S. equities, and particularly the equities everybody is talking about, that these equities have to be like some of the most discussed, most researched assets, and they're impacting people. It obviously impacts investors, but it's probably impacting a lot of people through their 401k or exposure to the S&P, or we have a global audience, you know, people in their US, one way or another, they're exposed to this. And a company's a complex thing, and valuation's complex, and there's a lot of different ways to look at it. So when you think about these companies, just take us through sort of the framework, your approach. What goes through your head?
I should have added to my experience was I primarily here at White's cover payments, semiconductors, and software. So my background is I've covered technology pretty closely for 10 years. And the way we look at things is we just look at it on a business by business basis, and not so much sort of, you know, what's the market level or what's the macro. In fact, when we start talking about macro, I get a little skittish in our investment meetings, just because that's something we can't control. And there are people that are way smarter than we are and would wipe the floor with us if we started to think that we could predict such things. But then when you look at, I mean, like what everybody's talking about today, I think, is NVIDIA, a business we don't own, a business that we've looked at in the past and sort of thought, well, that's interesting. And they make GPUs, or graphical processing units. It's a semiconductor that is used in gaming and used in media. And yeah, they've got this little side business over here that can power data centers and eventually autonomous vehicles. And then something called ChatGPT comes out in November, I think, of 2022. And that market cap of that business has just exploded. I think it's gone from a little over 200 billion to well over 2 trillion. I think it was like right close to Microsoft's market cap before it's pulled back here a little bit, which I don't follow it daily, but it's been driven by AI and lots of investor excitement around AI.
We're speaking in March. It's up 77% this year and 80% in the last 3 months.
Yeah, and doubled last year. Microsoft, similar things. The so-called Magnificent Seven have really captured people's imagination. They're a significant percentage of the S&P 500. So Yeah, our thoughts on it are there are very good businesses underneath them, even NVIDIA, which has had a past of boom and bust. You know, it's been around for something like 40 years, and it's continually grown even through these ups and downs. So it's a school of thought. Well, is this the late 90s bubble happening all over again and just replace GPUs or routers, which was drove everyone nuts with Cisco with GPUs? And, you know, I think it's interesting history. It never repeats, but it rhymes. I just wouldn't say, I'm very reluctant to call something a bubble or not when I haven't really looked at the larger picture. I would say overall, if you look at our portfolios and especially our tech holdings within them, we own, you know, semiconductors, we own software, we own the internet service companies like Alphabet, which is known as, everybody knows as Google, and Meta, Facebook. They're well off their lows of 2022. They, depending on the case, some of them are at our fair values or just below, and some are still somewhat below them, but they've all done well over the last, now through March, call it 15 months. And so, you know, where are earnings going to go? You always have to ask, is it, you're looking at intrinsic value, right? And intrinsic value is, you know, what's the sum of the present value of the discounted cash flows into the future? And a business like NVIDIA becomes that, that the scope of outcomes, you know, the probabilities you want to assign to sort of each case that you want to make on it just continues to widen, I think. And some would say skew higher. So if you thought it was worth $100 last year and the down case was say 50 and the up case was 150, well, you might think your base case today is 200 because, I mean, its earnings have gone up a lot. It's not just the stock price. Right. So now you're, and again, I'm just basing this off 100. You might think it's worth 400, but that range of outcomes could now, the low could be say 200, but the upside could be, I'm just making this up, 900, right? So
right.
You have this unbelievable upside skew. So you could see why investors collectively might just bid the whole thing up. And, you know, this is ignoring all the technical stuff, like how many people are using options to purchase a position. And then, you know, the market has to then go and hedge that by making sure they have the underlying. And there's just all these various things that come into play with these stocks. So looking at on a, it's NVIDIA is a fascinating case because you haven't seen a company grow revenue and earnings at this pace. I don't think ever in history. An example of somebody, and we'd have to check if this is true, but he said something along the lines of, I've never seen a company whose growth in net income over a year over year period was greater than the revenue it had in that period.
Huh.
And I look back and he's right. I can't remember the exact.
So who said this?
His name's Chris Bloomstrand. He's famous on Twitter among investors or some set of investors. He writes a huge annual letter each year, about 150 pages long.
Sounds fascinating. So I get that there's been this run up. There's a huge range of outcomes from here. So then you as an investor, how do you then try to, you know, take a company that you're comfortable speaking about? I don't know whether that's one you cover. Maybe it's more comfortable to speak about one you don't cover. So it's like, but anyways, you choose what's more comfortable for you. But my training is more macro. And one of the things you're thinking about in macro is that there are, if you will, speed limits, guidelines, ranges you can use. In other words, there's, you know, the U.S. economy, the real growth rate might be 2% or it might be minus 1%, but it ain't going to be 5%. It's just not going to happen. There's an upper limit to where it can go. And that then relates to the pricing of a short rate, which relates to the pricing of a bond, which relates to the PE. And you can sort of build out these architectures and then you know what you're arguing about, but it's relatively bounded. In other words, a bond investor will look, I was looking earlier today, what exactly meeting by meeting is expected out of the Fed? It's also bounded. You can say whether you agree or disagree with that.
Correct.
But I look at something like this technology and I read a lot, but I don't have that type of background. First of all, it strikes me is that that for something like this, you're dealing with a lot of the earnings are like, oh, what are next year's earnings? I'm thinking that you really ought to be looking 3 or 5 years out, which then, first of all, it's a discounted cash flow. But then the outcomes get even crazier. Because the interdependence of these things and the rate at which technology is going to happen and how the actors are going to respond one to another and then geopolitically what happens, blah, 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 blah. So how do you begin to chop that enormous problem into smaller components that you can get your head around as an investor?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the way we sort of look at it, I fall into this camp, is the old Buffett Munger thing. What's your circle of competence? What can you reasonably understand? What do you think you can reasonably predict? I mean, to your point, right? Can you find something with a limit? And a good example is, say, a cereal company in the U.S., right? That company's never going to grow 10% unless we have hyperinflation or something, and it's all price and it's volume, you know, it's raising price 12% and its volumes are down, you know, 9 or whatever to get you to 3%, right? It's not going to grow on a real basis that much. And it's also not going to shrink that much. People are not going to just stop eating cereal. So your range of outcomes is kind of +2, you know, -2. You can get really predictable. When you start talking about technology, and we'll just stick with NVIDIA, right? Because it's an interesting case study of, if you look out 3 years, and let's say 5, because I mean, as far as I understand it, basically all their orders they're booked through 2025. If you've ordered a GPU today for your startup or for your Microsoft or Meta, whether you need it or not, that semiconductor is going to be delivered to your doorstep or your server provider's doorstep, and you're going to take it. So NVIDIA is going to get paid. But what happens after that? It becomes very difficult because NVIDIA has very high margins. They're charging very high prices. And if you're Microsoft and Google, well, you've got your own semiconductor design teams.
Right.
They're trying to figure out a way to design NVIDIA out of that process.
Of course.
You know, this is where we get as longer term, we're long-term concentrated investors trying to invest in high quality businesses that we understand. That's the, you know, sort of marketing aspect of this, but it's also what we believe and what we do. And so that's why something like NVIDIA, especially here, kind of falls into the too hard pile, because the number of outcomes that you have to predict, the number of scenarios that have to be right, just go up the longer the stock price goes up or the higher the stock price goes. So a reasonable critique of that is, well, you were wrong 2 years ago. It's whatever the revenue has gone up. I don't want to misquote it, but it's a multiple of what it was and predicted in 2022 for, say, 23 and 24. So if you were long NVIDIA and you said, well, this data center thing is just going to do well, not only need to have that much go right for me to win. So now you're sitting here, you're the price is tripled or whatever it's done. And you as an investor are going, oh, this is easy. Who cares what happens next? And that's, I think that's where people get into traps, because
danger zone.
Yeah. The number of things that you needed to go right when the stock was sitting at 200 was very small. The things that you needed to go right today is a lot. Now, someone who knows the sector very deeply, someone who's followed AI and the evolution of transformer models and how GPU-centric they are and build the data centers, might have a very informed and different view from what I'm saying. But the way we look at things is, can we understand it? And as of today, the answer is no. So we just go shake hands with people that have done very well and say, good for you. And you've made our job even harder, because now as a percentage of index, it's larger and we have to make that up some other way. But if you're an investor and an intrinsic investor like we are, you can't know everything. It's hard enough to predict even the cereal companies, what they're going to do. You know, they could I think it was Kellogg that had one of their plants catch on fire, and they only have like 4 of them. And so you can't predict that. Well, the stock price got hammered on that. And did they ultimately make it back? I think so. But that eats into your business plan, because, you know, you're using a discount rate. And if you lose a certain amount of cash flows for a year, year and a half, the intrinsic value has gone down.
Of course.
You know, over the arc of time, you know, is it that much? No, but still it's been affected. So even things that you think are highly predictable have a degree of uncertainty about them.
I existed in a...
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you tired of feeling lost in the world of trading and investing? Get informed and inspired with the Talking Trading podcast. I'm Louise Bedford, and I'll help you navigate the markets like a pro. Tune in each week and subscribe now at talkingtrading.com.au or on your favorite podcast app, or check out the link in the show notes. Talking Trading, this is how traders excel.
A very rigorous compliance environment too. Yeah. So, you know, I understand you need to navigate this thing according to what's appropriate for your firm. But 2 points. First of all, on the outside looking in, So when I worked at Bridgewater, obviously it was of enormous interest to Wall Street what Bridgewater was doing. And on the inside, I knew exactly what our portfolio positions were. And I would see these reports all the time about Bridgewater's doing X, Bridgewater's doing Y, often from very reputable organizations. And they were like, the error rate was, I don't know, close to 90% on them. And of course, we could never say a thing because, you know, what. And so one of the things that struck me is, and since I've left, I've spent much more time on individual equities just because I find it so interesting and it wasn't something I did a lot of. But that experience always taught me about how hard it is on the outside looking at, now that's a private company versus a public. Public has to disclose much more so you get more information. But it's awfully hard on the outside looking in to know what's going on. So then take something like, I thought it was really interesting more recently that Google unveiled, I guess it was a paid thing, so I actually haven't experienced with it. I've used ChatGPT in my research, but Google unveiled their version of this, and I guess it gave wacky responses to people, and then the stock was punished. I looked at that, and I was like, what an interesting question. First of all, like, of course, if they're unveiling something new, it could be wacky and messed up, but I would assume that the first search results were pretty terrible too, and then they eventually got there. You know, they've just got bucket loads of cash. It seems like could be they're too bureaucratic and ossified to figure this out. But from the outside looking in, I would say there's probably reasonable odds they've got a lot of smart people they could pay for there to fix this thing. And so then now all of a sudden I'm jumping to like, okay, large language models and what's the math behind them? Blah, 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 blah. And then I'm like, okay, what would I have to do to really know this thing? Okay, well, I can read thoughtful analysis for other people, but if I was doing it myself, now I'm on a rabbit hole of like how these things work and what the math is behind them and enter. And it's really tricky because there's a balance. Like one of the things I've seen with really deep subject matter experts, and this happens a lot actually when I speak with thoughtful equity people, is they're like enthusiastically ignoring anything related to monetary policy. They're like, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to pay attention. And I'm like, it's not that complicated. You can figure out some of it. But then the people who are too macro, they ignore that stuff there. So it's very difficult to find this middle point. But if you can, take an example like that at Google. Like, how do you make sense of something like that? How do you narrow your odds?
Something like Google, and it was Gemini that they released, came out, and, you know, this is all public. You'd ask it to depict Nazis, and it refused to make white Nazis. I don't understand how that happened. And, you know, there's all sorts of things with prompt engineering, and the model is going to spit out whatever it's learned. It doesn't care, right? It's not a person. It's just math.
Right.
And it's doing math and sticking out. But you can tell it to do a different kind of math in a different way to get a result that's not offensive. You know, however, that we don't need to get into that because that's irrelevant to what we're talking about. But what you are asking is, what if there's a culture problem at Google? Or what if they can't figure out artificial, you know, generative AI and specifically transformer models, which, you know, the company invented, right? So is this a Xerox PARC situation where they figured out autonomous driving before anyone else? They figured out transformer models and artificial intelligence, and yet they can't monetize it. And, you know, is this Xerox PARC coming up with the graphical user interface and the mouse and all that? And so as of 12/31/2023, we owned Alphabet Google. So how do we as investors look at that and understand it, and what are the long-term implications? And you're right, you can't, in your example, you as a long-only investor, you can't ignore the macro, and you can't just dismiss, like, all, you can't get so in the weeds that you don't see the forest from the trees either. What we do is sort of look at that, and, you know, there's a qualitative element to every business, right? There's there's the stuff that a machine can do and can do very well, and you can't compete against it, right? It can do correlations against margins and sales momentum and all of that. But it can't really judge the quality of a management team. It can't really analyze competitive advantage except for what it can infer in the historical math it's looking at. And so that's where a long-only fundamental investor should be able to make a difference. And it's just an interesting time period here at Google because there does seem to be some cultural elements there that are preventing it from operating at top speed, right? But are they going to critically kill the business? And we don't think so. I mean, you know, I'm sort of, again, talking about a company we own, so you have to take that into consideration, but it's still got a dominant search business. We think if AI does everything, that business is still going to be there. Or more importantly, Google has many different ways of monetizing search with AI. He's got YouTube, which is a great business on in and of itself. And so then you had the management quality issues, capital allocation, and reinvestment. You know, Alphabet throws off a tremendous amount of cash. What are they going to do with that? How are they going to reinvest it? So these are difficult questions. You have to look at all of that, determine what it's worth, and then come up with a sort of saying, does this make sense versus what we can buy it for today or own it for today? And, you know, you're asking that all the time. And I'm not saying it's easy. It's not. It's very difficult. But the way we look at it is try to say there's certain things that are given, you know, the past is the past. So what does it look like going forward? And then we focus on sort of those more qualitative elements, because that's where we think we can still have an edge.
And how do you, like, one thing I was, after I thought about the Gemini thing, then I searched something, Google, and it came up. And my question was, boy, how much, maybe they're extracting aspects of that and then beginning to use it to improve the search. Would that ever be visible to me on the outside? And then I was like, well, would they ever have to disclose that in their 10K? You know, all those types of things. And it's more nuanced, because one of the things that does seem on the qualitative, the trickiest thing to price is how clever the innovation is by the leadership inside. Because you're not really betting on the existing business. You're sort of betting on how adaptable they'll be to whatever life throws at them in the next 5 to 10 years that you're sort of discounting those cash flows at. And one thing that I talk about this some in this book here, you know, there's also when I was working at Bridgewater, that was the time when Ray Dalio was in charge, and there was a lot of fascination with what Ray, you know, there's all this writing and blah, blah, blah. So I worked with him closely. And it was interesting for me to see what was in the press and what wasn't in the press. Like, one big thing that people have asked me and I've talked about is that I'd never seen somebody work so hard all the time, constantly. Like, I work pretty hard. I enjoy work. But, you know, it's a little bit like if you've done competitive sports, like you've seen some people who are just kind of fanatical about it. And that was never there. It was like, you know, Ray has this much money or Ray's done this and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, that's part of it. But then there's this other thing. Like, if you see that. No, it's not there. And so then I think about these companies, and like I think about a person like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, who was portrayed a certain way in a popular film. I've never met the guy. But, you know, how clever is somebody like that when TikTok comes along and what's going on in terms of all this? So it's that seems like a really difficult thing to get your mind around with confidence as an equity investor, particularly forward looking.
Yeah, it is. It's hard. And the way we look at it is you also don't want to get seduced by management.
Of course.
All CEOs, even somebody has been portrayed as awkward as Mark Zuckerberg. I don't know if he is or not, because I've never met him either. But, you know, they're great salespeople. They just are.
Of course they are.
You cannot get to that position without selling yourself, selling the product that your company represents. And so they're very good at using their just natural charisma to get you to think the way they think.
Totally.
And of course, the way these CEOs are, their company is always the greatest. It's always undervalued. Doesn't matter what the price is. They're only the famous Scott McNeely quote about what were you thinking when he went through the whole math of like we were trading at 100 times earnings and, you know, it would take you forever to get it back. So you have to keep management and what you think of them and what they're doing in the context of the overall entity, and that these are people you're dealing with at the end of the day. And companies are made of people. And I think the hardest thing that companies have is communicating what they're trying to do and focusing on those things. It doesn't matter if it's 1,000 or one. Yeah, you know, the number of things that you're trying to do, as that goes up, the communication becomes more difficult. But you have to wrap it around, especially these very large companies. A large part of their businesses are sustainable. I mean, for goodness sakes, IBM is still making a killing on mainframes. When you're evaluating these companies and what they're doing, and especially in technology, I mean, technology is not some sort of mystical thing all off to itself. I mean, think about what it's like to evaluate a high-tech product, which people don't think of it as a jet engine, right? A jet engine is one of the, next to semiconductors, is the second greatest miracle that mankind has created. just in terms of its complexity and all of that. So there are products, whether they're intellectual property or hard property, like a jet engine. And it's just a series of building blocks, if you will, that you have to evaluate. And the hard part of this puzzle is, like, not all those building blocks matter. So you need to distill down to what you believe matters, put it in the appropriate context, and then see how that relates to what something is worth. You know, sometimes it looks really easy. You just buy NVIDIA in November of 2022 and put all your wealth into it, and you don't even think about it. But that's just not the way the world works.
Right. How much do you think about ecosystems in the following sense? In other words, as I tried to understand the tech thing, I was like, okay, well, the AI needs a lot of chips, so who's doing the big AI investment? I was like, it's established companies. And who's the best chip designer? Okay, well, NVIDIA is one of them. Well, who makes the top-of-the-line chips? Well, that's Taiwan Semiconductors. Who creates the lithography for that? That's his. All right, who ships the chips? Blah, blah. And then I was all the way down to, like, who makes the electricity? So for me, in macro, I'm sort of all about how the thing fits together. But when you're looking at, like, for instance, you know, payments, take that thing. Are you like, okay, I have to understand the way cash moves in the United States. Now I have to understand bank transfers. Now I have to, do you like look at the entire ecosystem to judge the pieces? Or is it more like, here are a couple of interesting payments companies that I'm going to know really well?
No, you have to look at the ecosystem. You have to start with the ecosystem and making sure that you believe there's a basis for understanding it. If you can't do that, you should move on to the next thing. Because nothing operates in a vacuum. And there's so much interdependency. And, you know, you're right. A lot of sort of fundamental long-only investors go, oh, I'd never pay attention to the macro. But it's not that you shouldn't pay attention to the macro. You should pay attention. You should understand what's going on, being aware of your surroundings. But what you shouldn't do is try to guess or make your investment decisions based on what you think is going to happen next, is what I would argue. You just have to, again, put it in the framework and the context of the investment that you're making, in this case, in equity, and being aware of things that might change. I mean, if you weren't thinking about what Russia might do as they mass troops on the border, if you had an investment in a Russian company or a bank, I don't look at the macro. Okay, well, you've learned a lesson. So ecosystem is vitally important. Understanding it is vitally important.
So you started out as an accountant. There's obviously gazillion numbers that you can look at as an equity investor. I started off my career doing currency initially, and currencies are also incredibly complex. But after years and years of looking at it, it actually only came to, like, there was literally probably three or four things that you sort of had to know or else you were crazy.
Right.
And then there was lots of other things that you could look at and look at and look at, but it didn't. And I actually found that with a lot of things, I found that there was hundreds of numbers you could look at, but there was maybe kind of a couple that without them, you were just lost type of thing. So when you look at a company describing its financial performance, are there certain things that you are, that are sort of like your touchstones?
Yeah, I think number one is, and it's very simple, is organic growth. Can the company grow organically, and can it grow above nominal GDP for a sustainable period of time? And then the second one is, it's really a trend, is what is the trend on return on invested capital? And looking at that, you know, you need to look at it historically, and then you need to understand sort of what the forward projections are looking like. Because something has great return on invested capital, but let's say it's gone from, making these numbers up, 30 to 25 to 20. You know, if you're betting it's going to go back to 30, you better have a good reason for doing so. And all of these sort of basic critical numbers that you would look at, the two or three that we do, and then reinvestment rate is another one, but that's not really a number. It is, but it's a highly qualitative element to it. Those are just sort of scanning mechanisms, I would say, or a good way to summarize whether that's where you should spend your next block of time. We think about it all the time. We call it return on research time invested. If we spend a week on this, you know, what's the return for us? Is it going to be worth it or not? And then, you know, yes or no, and move on. So having sort of those various elements, just starting with them, helps you determine, make that return on research time invested calc.
And why do you find those so predictive in terms of the reliability of an equity investment?
Well, they're equities, right? So nothing is ever set in stone. But generally, if companies have good organic growth and they have a good trend and a good, at least stable trend in return on invested capital, they probably are high quality businesses. And then you're already dealing with something that is probably more predictable than the average security. that just narrows the opportunity set down. It narrows where you should spend your time. And then that hopefully allows you to sort of make good decisions. You still have to look at valuation. You just can't buy something that looks good. You know, it has to be trading at what you believe a discount to intrinsic value is, or you eventually you're going to lose.
But with technology, isn't that looking at things like that, just it sort of circles back to what would be like for those companies to be doing that, growing faster than GDP, and you're looking out 5 years, you really have to be imagining a very different future than the one we're in. And so it's something that, to take the Gemini example, there's something that Gemini begins to do that's magical that begins to direct a lot of attention to it that it hasn't been directed in the past that results in cash flows.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, back when I was looking at Google and Microsoft and the like in, you know, 07, 08 and all that, very few what were then called value investors were looking at anything like that. And you'd be crazy to look at it. That's changed. Almost anybody that's involved in sort of active fundamental management has somebody looking at technology every day. And so back to our beginning of the conversation where, you know, what are the number of things that you need to predict and predict correctly in order for this investment to work out well for you? That number has gone up. So the level of competition has gone up. It's become more difficult to make those sorts of estimates and judgments. And so we'll see what happens in another 10 years. Maybe we aren't talking about technology because just basically flattened in the index, but you're right. So that's a competition part, but I don't think a lot of what these companies do is all that different than somebody's looking at General Motors in the 60s.
Right.
A lot of them are very large. If you're doing anything in business, you're going to need a database. And so which one and all of that, but we're not talking about in the 1960s or something like that, which electronics firm were you going to buy because they were all going to go to the moon? There's elements of that that have happened. I mean, the 2000s had that with the internet bubble. You could argue post-COVID, just about everything was like that. I sort of push back on the sort of like, isn't that more difficult to know than something else? And, you know, to agree it is, but I don't think it's that big a leap. And maybe I'm fooling myself. I generally tend to go, well, I don't think I can understand that, so I'm just going to ignore it. Like security software is a great example. I've stared at those security software stocks several times, and I've just determined that, one, there's always a new threat. It's not clear that company A's solution to today's threat will be available for next year's threat. And, you know, that was probably a mistake because what happens is companies just keep the same software and keep updating it. And then as a new threat comes, they just buy new software on top of that. So
thank you. This is super helpful. Thank you for listening to today's episode. We're genuinely touched by all the support. If you want to see more of this type of content, sign up to my Substack on paulpodolsky.com and become a paid subscriber. That helps support the team. You could also submit a review to Apple Podcasts, which draws other listeners to this. If you have any questions, you can email me, paul@paulpodolsky.com, and follow me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Thanks so much.